Welcome to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where national experts bring you facts and answers. I'm your host, Dr. Onit Lev, an emergency and addiction doctor who has served at the White House and still practices on the front lines. Right here on High Truths, you will learn from experts from around the globe and around all aspects of drugs and addiction. To grow this community of information and action, I hope you give us a five-star review. Come visit me on hightruths.com to learn more about the show or download a free prescription for naloxone. Carrying naloxone for drugs is like carrying an EpiPen for allergies. Today's episode is sponsored by Physicians for Healthy Communities, a physician-led organization that educates on the science of prevention to improve public health. Visit their website to learn how they prevent substance misuse while supporting individuals, families, and communities. Go to physiciansforhealthycommunities.org. Hello again, High Truths listeners. Get ready for a chicken and egg conversation. I'm your host, Dr. Ronit Lev. Chicken and egg, as in the age-old question of which came first, the chicken or the egg. It seems like an impossible question. One follows the other. A person of faith, though, may think the answer is easy. The chicken came first, of course, because God created the animals, and only then did they lay eggs. But this is not a religious conversation. Instead of chicken and egg, we will ask which came first, cannabis use or schizophrenia. Many parents have asked me this nagging question. Did my child develop schizophrenia or bipolar disorder because of their marijuana use? Or was my child genetically disposed to having schizophrenia or other mental health challenge regardless of marijuana use? I don't always have the answer, but I can offer some insights. We can tackle the difficult question in a population-based method and on an individual basis. As a population, there's no doubt that there's a rise in young people developing schizophrenia and mental health problems, and there is a direct causation with marijuana. This has been proven by large population studies and the Bradford Hill criteria, proving causation, not just correlation, between marijuana and psychosis. A Canadian study of 11,363 records showed an 11-fold risk of psychosis for cannabis users ages 12 to 19. 11-fold. That's a lot. Check out the podcast I did with Dr. Andre McDonald, the author of this study. In a study of nearly 7 million people in Denmark, not only did they prove the high risk of psychosis and cannabis use, but they also stated that 30% of schizophrenia diagnosis could have been prevented in men aged 21 to 30 if they didn't use cannabis. Check out my podcast with the study authors, Sir Robin Murray and Dr. Martha DeForte. Why don't we have these studies in America? The European countries operate in a socialized medical system and track all these data. And we don't. Studies have shown that all drugs can cause a temporary psychosis that can convert into a permanent mental health illness. However, marijuana has the highest conversion rate, over 40%, more than methamphetamine or other drugs, meaning the one or two time psychotic episode can convert into a life sentence. So, as a population, no one can argue that cannabis is a risk factor for psychosis and mental illness. Just like tobacco is a risk factor for heart disease and cancer, not everyone who smokes cigarettes is going to get lung cancer, but it's a risk. And not everyone who uses pot will get mental illness, but it's a risk. And the risk is greater for young people and with high potency products. Check out the Isaac Library for references. Isaac is the International Association on the Science and Impact of Cannabis. So we have a population answer to our chicken and egg question. What about the individual? What do I say to parents who understandably care more about their child rather than epidemiological data? For the individual, I ask a couple questions. Number one, does schizophrenia or mental illness run in the family? If there is no family history of mental illness, then cannabis becomes a bigger culprit. The second question is, number two, did the psychosis go away when the young person stopped using marijuana? If psychosis intermittently resolves when marijuana use is stopped, especially in the early years of use, this would be a very good indicator that cannabis caused the schizophrenia. This information is very important to my colleagues in psychiatry. First, it says, never blow off the association of marijuana use and mental health crisis. Also, never assume that a young person has schizophrenia or bipolar disorder if they also use marijuana. Such an assumption dooms the person to a lifelong mental health diagnosis. On the other hand, if you overdiagnose cannabis-induced psychosis and always attribute a young person's mental health crisis to marijuana, assuming they're using, you will give that person hope for a full recovery and productive life if they stop using. An individual may still develop a permanent mental illness, but statistically, you will be saving many brains with a more aggressive approach in diagnosing cannabis-induced psychosis and seriously recommending cannabis cessation. To learn more about the chicken or egg for cannabis psychosis and schizophrenia, I reached out to Dr. David Ritu. Dr. David Ritu is a child and adolescent psychiatrist who currently works at the medical director of the Lane County Behavioral Health in Eugene, Oregon. Before moving to Oregon in 2021, he worked as a tenured associate professor of psychiatry and pediatrics at the University of Vermont Medical Center and was a medical director of the Child and Families Division of Vermont Department of Mental Health. He is author of over 60 peer-reviewed journal articles, books, and writes a regular blog on Psychology Today. To learn more about Dr. Ritu, check out the High Truths show notes. Dr. David Ritu, welcome to High Truths.
It's great to be here. Thank you, Dr. Lev.
It's great. I got to meet you briefly in Oregon at the Cannabis Policy Summit, and I heard you speak, and I said, I need to have this guy on High Truths. And then I also remembered, and I want to thank you for the work that you've done with ISAC, the International Academy on Science and Impact of Cannabis. We bring leaders from around the globe, like you, who speak out and educate on the realities of marijuana. So I thought to start out with, we'd get to know you a little bit. You're a child and adolescent psychiatrist. What made you want to do that? Is that something that you say, hey, when I grow up, I'm going to be a psychiatrist?
Well, I've always been interested in why people do what they do and trying to help people with mental health challenges. I graduated from college, not sure whether I was going to be a psychologist or a psychiatrist, but then had the privilege of working at the National Institutes of Mental Health in their child psychiatry branch. And it was there that I really got very excited about the field of child psychiatry and went to medical school thinking that that was what I was going to do, but trying to keep an open mind at the same time. And I had a great experience in medical school, and nothing veered me off from that path to become a child psychiatrist. So it was a choice I made a long time ago, and I'm very glad that I did. It's been a very rewarding career.
It's amazing how much our childhood experiences and opportunities really shape our lives like that. I'm wondering if you fit the profile of a psychiatrist. And I tell people my favorite meetings is when I get ER doctors and psychiatrists together, because the ER doctors are all fired up and talking a lot. And by the end of the meeting, we realize, hey, the psychiatrist didn't say anything. They just listened.
Yeah, I don't know what the typical profile is anymore. I don't have the tweed jacket. I don't have a beard. So in some ways, I may be a little bit different. And I like to live in more rural areas, which I think is also a little bit different than a lot of psychiatrists. But we're a different group. It's hard to just put us all in one box. We have, you come from different backgrounds, have different ideas and different perspectives. And I think that's one of the things that actually enriches our field.
Yeah. Of course, I am generalizing a lot, but you tend to be calm and soft-spoken in general.
Personally, I'm a little bit more on the introvert side, and I do a lot of listening. I'll probably talk more today than I typically do in a week.
All right, and I asked our audience at the beginning of this podcast that I gave a little information about chicken or the egg, cannabis use or a genetic disposition to schizophrenia or mental illness. This comes a lot. I don't know if parents ask you this when they have a child who has a problem, and I kind of want to hear your perspectives on that.
Yes, this question comes up a lot because there are certainly quite a bit of data that shows that there is an association between cannabis use and the development of psychotic disorders like schizophrenia. But that doesn't mean all by itself that cannabis causes psychosis. And so this is a question. People want to know the chicken or the egg. I think what the research is tending to show is that even though this question is usually phrased as an or, is it the cannabis causing schizophrenia, or does the schizophrenia cause some people to want to use cannabis more? It doesn't have to be an or question, and it's probably an and question. There are probably lots of different pathways operating in different people in different ways. There are certainly some studies that are better equipped to tease out the chicken or egg question, and they can be pretty technical, and it's probably not worth going into them right now. But those tend to indicate that all of these pathways can be present, and that they're maybe genetic factors that lead to both cannabis use and psychotic disorders. But there also is a pathway where cannabis use can lead more directly to psychosis. And there may be even be some reverse causation in which people who are prone to experience psychotic disorders may be prone to use cannabis. So all of these things can be happening at the same time. There's certainly also a pretty strong research literature that shows that cannabis use, if you are exhibiting signs of psychotic disorders, can make the course of that condition worse and make it more difficult to treat. So even if the cannabis wasn't causal, you're making your prognosis worse by continuing to use cannabis.
Makes sense. If you have lung cancer not because of tobacco and you keep smoking, it's going to make your prognosis worse.
Yeah, right. These things often work similarly.
And when we were in Oregon together at the summit, you talked a little bit about cannabis and the brain, the hippocampus, the corpus callosum, the endocannabinoid system. I wonder if you could touch base just a little bit about that to educate our audience.
Yeah, there have been a number of studies that have tried to look at the effects of cannabis on the brain, and some of these have some of the same limitations, chicken egg questions that we have with cannabis and psychotic disorders. Two areas of the brain that seem to come up a fair amount in terms of how cannabis can affect the development of the adolescent brain. One is an area that you mentioned called the hippocampus, which is an area that's very deep in the brain. I think people maybe have heard of this area as being important for memory, and it is, but it's also important for other functions such as emotional regulation. And then another area that tends to come up a fair amount is an area called the prefrontal cortex. It's a part of the brain that is right behind your forehead. And this is an area that is quite important for what are often called executive functioning skills, planning, delayed gratification, regulating emotions. And so these studies sometimes implicate one or both of those regions, but it's a messy literature. The neuroimaging research in everything can sometimes be inconsistent. There's different ways of looking at it. You can look at brain structure, you can look at brain function. I think one exciting development is probably the most definitive study that has ever been done is currently underway. It's called the ABCD study, the Adolescent Brain and Cognitive Development Study. And this is a study that started several years ago, looking at thousands of kids beginning at, I think, around the age of 10. And they're, if I remember correctly, they're now teenagers. And they are following this very large group of kids from all over the country for many years, and doing testing and neuroimaging and genetic and looking at environmental. And for the first time, I think we'll be able to actually see what the brains of a lot of these kids look like before they actually use any substances. And then you can really look at, you can more definitively look at the possibility of causation. So I'm excited. There's already been hundreds of studies that have been, that have come out of this group. The data is actually publicly available. And I think we're going to get some more definitive answers soon.
Yes, and we've done, I think, a couple podcasts on the ABCD study. It's the largest longitudinal study in history, looking at lots of things, not just drugs, and definitely seeing the adverse effects of even in utero, right? Like the moms who've used cannabis have kids who suffer with anxiety even until, you know, 6 or 7 years old, right, from that effect. And then they're following these, you know, kids from, again, from birth onward. So yeah, we do see that harms there. In my interaction with colleagues, I see a resistance to making the diagnosis of cannabis-induced psychosis. Doctors are saying, well, it's just marijuana, and kind of blow it off. They don't want to deal with the patients or confront them with the cannabis use. It very much reminds me of the opioid days where, like, I'm not going to tell my patient that you're using too many opioids for their pain. It's a difficult conversation with patients. It's better just to avoid it. And then they don't want to make the diagnosis of cannabis-induced psychosis because, like, well, what if they do have schizophrenia? It's kind of like the same age group. So they kind of let it go. And I think this is a grave mistake, because in blowing off patients, you're robbing them their opportunity from stopping marijuana and having a normal life. If you're just going to let it go and it's just weed and not make that diagnosis, then you're potentially condemning an individual to a lifelong struggle with mental illness. So I think it should be like an opt-in diagnosis rather than a diagnosis of exclusion. That's kind of my thoughts for this episode, and I want to run them by you.
I would completely agree. Certainly, I can respect people wanting to be cautious when you attribute or conclude that some symptoms are due to a particular reason. But I completely agree. I can remember when I was supervising residents who were seeing patients in the emergency department, and people would come in with psychotic symptoms, for example. And it very clearly looked like it was linked to their cannabis use. And I would ask, well, any drug use in this patient? And I would hear sometimes, oh, just marijuana. And I would say, well, why are you using the word just? This could certainly be a really important and meaningful thing that you have to bring up. And to me, someone presenting to the emergency department with potentially cannabis-induced psychosis or other symptoms, that to me is like the equivalent of showing up to the emergency department with chest pain. And this, in my view, is your brain speaking very loudly and clearly that it does not like this stuff, and that there are serious risks of continuing in this path. And the data support that. There was a study that came out just recently that showed that individuals who present to the emergency department with cannabis-induced psychosis are at extremely high risk. You were talking about maybe conversion up to, you know, 40% or so of having a psychotic disorder. And so if you do nothing, I think that's a real that's really not a good service to our patients. And if you attribute it to other reasons, it also, I think, can lead to medication overuse. So if someone presents, and I see this a fair amount, with psychotic symptoms, and you don't bring up the cannabis use, well, you're depriving them of a potentially reversible cause. And so you instead maybe are putting people on antipsychotic medications, which can be useful, but themselves can carry significant risks and some serious side effects. And if you can spare people that by showing them another path, I think it's really our obligation to do so.
All right, Dr. Ritu, I love this because I wrote my little monologue before I had this conversation with you, and you've given me some validation. I think this, you know, you and I both had a long career in medicine, and we see gaps in our community. And I think this is one of them that that we need to fix. Actually, next week, I'm going to speak to a group of psychiatrists at Sharp Mesa Vista, adolescent and child psychologists, and I'm going to mention that. I'll mention you. And let me ask you if there's any advice you have to me before I face a group of your colleagues that I should be sharing.
Well, one of the things that has surprised me across the board, and this is not just parents, but this is also medical professionals, is that we really can't assume that people know about this research. I admit I did not get a lot of training of this, even though I went to a very good psychiatry and child psychiatry training program. In fact, the whole reason I got into this whole advocacy area is because I was forced to do a talk on this, and I thought, well, I would educate myself, and it really opened up a lot. So I would don't assume that even medical professionals really know this. There's so much propaganda out there that I think we can really do a service by just educating people on where the data and the research actually are.
Yeah, and you're right. And then we've seen this before, right? So early in my career with the opioid prescription, the medical community drank the Kool-Aid as far as, like, you know, opioids doesn't cause addiction if you're really in pain. And I think I see the medical community kind of going down the same road, and, you know, they're getting the information from the industry or whatever else is, you know, common on the news, and not really from the extensive medical literature that talks about the harms. Let's talk a little bit about your experience and your historical experience as a child and adolescent psychiatry. How has the field evolved, you know, since the beginning of your training? I'm sure you've seen some changes and improvements. And then how have patients evolved during this time?
Well, I think during this more recent period, where there's been a lot in the public and in politics related to issues of legalization, I think parents and medical professionals alike have been hearing this, and a lot of it is cherry-picked or not, I think, very sound scientific information, and we've all been picking this up. So I think in our field, there for a while was a long period of complacency. A lot of the, quote, just marijuana attitude out there. Fortunately, I feel like people are starting to wake up. I also think that there has been a lot of political overshading of this issue and this idea that if you bring up concerns about cannabis use in youth, that somehow you're some extreme conservative. And in my view, that people have concerns from all different political backgrounds, and this is really not and nor should it be a politically charged topic. So, but I think those things have held us back. But now, as the data just keeps coming in and the studies just keep pouring in, it's becoming hard to ignore, and it feels like our medical community and our mental health community is really in a better place to accept what we've been learning.
It's funny, I think at the beginning of our career, you know, marijuana was known as, like, not healthy for your brain. Now we've kind of swung the other way, and now we need to, like, swing back to reality. But are there any other...
Well, part of this was the whole, quote, medical marijuana movement, which I think has been really destructive in a lot of ways. Because of this, it's not as though there are no data that suggests that some components of the cannabis plant can have some value, but the way those data have been really twisted for advocacy, And the way that this medical marijuana process exists completely outside of the way any other prescribed product exists is just, the more I think about it, the more bizarre it is. I mean, I can't think of any other substance where you would say, well, you know, I'll sign off on this, but I have nothing to say about dosing or frequency. I'll just leave it to you. I mean, can you imagine doing that with anything else that we prescribe? It just doesn't make any sense.
We would lose our license.
The prevailing system that we have across multiple states right now.
All right, you're now like my top favorite psychiatrist because I actually think they hijacked the word medical for political gain, and I am really appalled at our profession for not jumping in and objecting, because it destroys. You know, why go to medical school if you could just be a bud tender and recommend whatever you want, right? I mean, I would lose my license if I don't get a history and physical exam and vital signs and check for drug interactions and make a risk-benefit calculation for anything that I prescribe or recommend. And medical marijuana doesn't follow any of that standard of care.
Yeah, and I'm a big believer in personal freedoms. I think people should make their own choices. And personally, I would just be much less irritated with the cannabis industry if they could just admit that the primary reason that people use cannabis is to get high and not to slap green medical crosses.
Yeah, glaucoma.
Like wellness
seizures
in their clinics. I just find that a complete sham. And I really wish that we could just have an honest discussion about why people make choices to use this and what the effects are. But this hiding behind a wellness cloak, I think, is extremely destructive.
Now, anything else in psychiatry, not just for marijuana or drugs, but in general, big improvements you've seen through your career, medications, you know?
Yeah, thank you for bringing that up, because another development in the field of psychiatry that I am really excited about is that I think over the past few decades, psychiatrists, in part because there are so few of us, I've really been pushed into the role of psychopharmacologists. And that's psychopharmacology is very important, and I certainly prescribe my share of medications. But I think many of us have begun to realize that we have been confined into a box that has really limited our ability to be helpful. And there are now, I don't know if movements are the right word, but there are certainly some enthusiasm to bring in more health promotion, lifestyle, social determinants of health, really looking at the big picture into what really determines behavior and development over the long term. And this has been called positive psychiatry or lifestyle psychiatry. There was a model where I was before called the Vermont family-based approach that says psychiatrists really need to be mental health professionals, not just mental illness professionals. Mm-hmm. And that means looking at and helping patients with all kinds of things that used to be considered kind of out of our lane. And that can include exercise and nutrition and parenting practices and sleep and talking about screens and, you know, all of these really, and talking about social determinants of health, all of these things that are, we know, are really, really important in shaping a child's trajectory. Yet we've kind of ignored that, or we've left that to other fields. So I'm very excited that psychiatry is bringing this back. I'm seeing this more discussed in mainstream conferences and in journals, and I think it's a really important and exciting development for our field.
That's interesting, because at the beginning of your career, you said you kind of like, should I be a psychologist? Should I be a psychiatrist? And it has been typically the psychology field that maybe talked about that and did the various types of talk therapy without medication. And if you need medications, that goes to the psychiatrist. And so, like you said, de facto, psychiatrists just take care of the, you know, the worst in mental illness.
Well, that's been our stereotype, but I think we're pushing back against that, and I think we should. If somebody refers to me as a prescriber, that word is like fingernails on chalkboard to me. And it just does not reflect the work that I do. Some students have commented that when they sit in with me with patients, that in a 30-minute follow-up visit, I might spend 20 minutes talking about parenting practices and school and friendships and screens, and then I'm kind of famous with 5 minutes left in the appointment of the appointment saying, "Oh, is there anything about the medicines that we should talk about?" So that's when people say, "Well, you do the meds." I just find that really almost insulting to the work that we do. And again, it's not to diminish the importance of good psychopharmacology, and I certainly will have appointments where that's the focus, but we do much more than that, and we really also welcome a team approach where we have psychologists and social workers and peer supports who are all working together to try to help.
You know, it reminds me of a little bit how I feel about my profession in emergency medicine, because I see the worst of what's happening in society and people, you know, and harms. It makes me not just want to fix a problem, but also prevent it, right? So if we're seeing all these car accidents, we want to talk about how do we prevent car accidents or violence. If somebody is, you know, we're seeing a lot of people who fall and break their hip, then, you know, we're going to fix your hip. But like, how do we talk about a little bit, how do you prevent from falling next time? I want to know how you fell down so you can make a change in your life so you won't fall again. And bringing that prevention aspect to patient work and then also health policy. And I kind of see you doing that also as far as, you know, mental health and well-being.
Yeah, I love that. And that's been a focus of my career too. I just stepped off as being the co-chair of the Health Promotion and Prevention Committee of the American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry. Prevention is a huge topic. I think it's been undervalued undertaught in psychiatry fields. And I agree, it's important to really help people who are struggling right now and have, you know, serious mental health challenges. But it's also really important to work upstream because to some degree, these are preventable conditions. And if you can work on parenting, if you can treat parental mental health problems, if you can try to make the prenatal period as stable and healthy as possible, all of these things can have huge downstream impacts. And I feel like psychiatry needs to be in all of these places.
All right, that's it. You are my favorite psychiatrist when you talk about upstream prevention. That's awesome. You went from Vermont to Oregon, and Oregon, I learned by visiting Oregon, ranks 50th in the nation in addiction treatment access and the second highest in untreated addiction. I wonder if you see that in the patient population moving from Vermont to Oregon.
Yeah, I have seen that. The mental health systems and substance use treatment systems are challenged everywhere. And Vermont, which has the reputation of being very good with access, I know, you know, my colleagues and I struggled getting patients the care that they needed there as well. So I see it everywhere. One thing I've noticed about Oregon, and I imagine some other states it may be true as well, is that from a regulatory standpoint and a licensing standpoint, mental health and substance use are treated as very different things. They kind of have different pathways, and it leads to a siloing of care, which just is not the way the brain works. You know, the brain just doesn't respect this box between substance use and mental health. These two things are intricately related. And I think one of the things that we have struggled with is this artificial distinction. So I've had adolescents who have struggled both with significant mental health challenges and significant substance use. And we struggle getting them, say, residential care because the substance use facilities say, no, we can't bring them in because of their mental health problems. And the mental health facility says, oh, no, we can't bring them in because of their substance use problems. And it's frustrating. But I think people are hearing this and making some efforts to kind of.
Yeah, that needs to end. That's unacceptable. I mean, 50% of everyone who has a substance disorder has some type of mental health problem. So how can we
differentiate? Right. And regardless of which pathway they had to get there, whether the substance use caused the mental health, they still probably need help in both of those areas to really get where they need to go.
Right. You, in your presentation, and I say this kind of like Vermont and Oregon had different trajectories and legalization of marijuana, but you mentioned that states that legalized marijuana have a higher use in kids, but yet the industry says, oh, no, look, in all the states that we've legalized, we have not seen an increase in youth use.
Well, I think to be fair, the states that have been the first to legalize often had the highest rates of youth cannabis use to start with. So states like Colorado, Oregon and Washington, Alaska, Vermont. But I think the trick here is really. I think the key here is about the perception of harm. And there have been some really good studies that show that the likelihood of an adolescent using cannabis is really directly related to the degree of risk they see in doing that. And over time, the perceived level of risk has changed, and it moves in almost lockstep with the amount of use. It's really remarkable if you see these graphs. And I think that's what these states that have, that tend to legalize quickly and then also have really high rates, I think that's what links this together, is that there's this culture of this perception that there really are no risks. This is a plant, it's safe, there's nothing bad that can happen. And when I try to educate youth and parents about this, some of them are really genuinely surprised when I say no, that there really have been these documented risks. They really have never heard this, and it's a real service to be able to just provide that education.
Yeah, when I talk to patients too, it'll be like, no one ever told me that. It's like, yeah, I know. But you mentioned something about the incidence of cannabis use disorder is higher than the incidence of, you know, pain pill addiction, methamphetamine, cocaine, stimulants, and heroin combined. That was back in 2020. You think that's still true?
I think it probably is true. I've just heard some really nice and heartening statistics about opiate-related deaths dropping recently. So there could be some changes very recently. But there's been some interesting trends that are moving in different directions. So if you do a survey and you ask youth, have you ever tried marijuana? Have you tried it in 30 days? You often get a relatively flat, you know, the needle hasn't moved much. Although I would put it in context, because our current Gen Z generation uses less substances in general than previous generations. And so rates of alcohol use, rates of nicotine use are actually dropping, while cannabis is maintaining relatively flat. However, if you actually look at cannabis use disorder, so people who are really getting into trouble with their cannabis use and having adverse effects and developing tolerance and having withdrawal symptoms, those numbers actually seem to be getting a little bit worse among youth. And so you're seeing different patterns. And one way that people are trying to explain this has to do with the potency of cannabis products. So 40 years ago, the average THC content might have been 3 to 4%. This is sort of grandpa's marijuana use back in the 60s. And now it's it can be 10 times that. And there is increasing research that's showing that these products that are 30%, and now they're these concentration products that can be even more potent, 80-90% THC, that the potency is another factor in determining a risk of a variety of mental health conditions.
You know, I just heard a presentation from our local children's hospital, Dr. Natalie Laub, and she showed this was United States data and use by age. And she showed that the largest rate of increase, like, you know, if you look at 16, 17-year-olds, the amount of use is about stable. But if you look at 11-year-old girls, this is shocking, 11-year-old girls, that their rate of rise has, like, tripled over the years. And that's a demographic that we haven't been talking about at all.
No, I wasn't aware of that. And I also think the more I do this work, the more I become convinced that one of the strongest pathways through which cannabis and other substances harm kids is actually through their parents, and how parental use can lead to everything from neglect to sometimes outright abuse. Over the years, especially lately, the opiates have really gotten the headlines for all of this, and certainly there's some reasons for that. But if you actually look at some of the data, I looked at some state data about what were the drugs that parents were using when their kids were removed from the home. Cannabis use was the most common. And again, I think people just don't really perceive the harm. But unfortunately, I see that, and the data show that as well.
Yeah, and the other thing that I showed our suicide prevention team here in San Diego is their own local data in people who died in suicide and the drugs found on autopsy, and the number one drug by far, like, a lot more than alcohol, was marijuana for age under 25. So my plea to them was, when you're doing your prevention work, your suicide prevention work, include this as a risk factor. And here's the data.
Yeah, the picture with suicide and cannabis, I think, has not received as much attention as things like psychosis. But the data is really clear, and there have been some really large studies with thousands of people that have shown this link. And again, there always will be a few chicken and egg questions, but the link is definitely there, and it's quite strong, and it reflects what I've seen clinically in my practice.
So I was asked recently, what's the youngest age of somebody you've seen with a problem with marijuana? And a physician in Colorado said that she took care of someone with cannabis use disorder and psychosis in a 7-year-old. I don't know how common that is. I haven't seen that age, but what about you?
I cannot say that I've seen that in a 7-year-old. But I have seen cannabis use in tweens and young teenagers, and this is this is a time where the risk is much higher. I think it's a really important point to say is that the link between cannabis use and particularly mental health problems is quite age dependent. Not that there is a period that there's no risk. But the mental health risks of using cannabis when you're 14, 15, 16 years old look to be much, much higher than they are when somebody is 40 years old. And that is probably because adolescence is a period where there is so much happening dynamically in the brain. The brain does a lot of different things. It may look like it's not doing much, but it really is. And there are periods in development where it's really ratcheting up its rate of reaching out new connections. There are periods where it's working hard to reduce and pruning back connections. And adolescence is this is one of those times where the speed of different developmental processes are really changing. And so it actually makes a lot of biological sense that the risks associated with cannabis use are particularly evident around adolescence.
Yeah, that makes sense. We're also talking about, when we're talking about a lot of focus on opioids getting a lot of attention. And if I ask any of my patients who overdosed on fentanyl, or saved by naloxone, or there to get some Suboxone, what's the first drug you've ever used? They'll say, oh, you know, maybe I used heroin at 20. And then I'll say, no, what's the first drug you ever used? And sometimes they don't even connect that marijuana is a drug. Oh, weed? Oh, that. I did that 11 years old. Nowadays, it's invariably that marijuana is the first drug used to start priming the brain. And it makes sense biologically, right? You're creating an increased need of dopamine with marijuana, and then, you know, you move on to other things. I know people don't like the word gateway theory, but this is just the science and the data that we have about that. So when we talk about fentanyl, I don't think you can really care about fentanyl without going upstream and talking about marijuana. And upstream from marijuana is just resiliency and mental health and the things that you talk about.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think the early use of cannabis and alcohol, that is the piece that is very often lacking in the narratives of our opiate crisis. And certainly we have to pay attention to things like the overprescribing of opiates. And those are really important pieces, but you almost never hear that that for many people, the path started with things like alcohol and cannabis. And we can't ignore that part, too. That's not to blame people for their use, but we need to understand it. And I agree that that is a piece that's often missing in these stories.
All right. So now let's get a little of the good psychiatrist talk from you. Tell us if you have a young person, a patient in front of you who's using marijuana, and they're telling you, it's my medicine, it helps my anxiety, hey, it's safer than Valium, Adderall, it helps me sleep. How do you approach this young individual sitting in front of you?
This comes up a lot. And I would say in general, I am trying to walk a fine line between validating their experience, because I think often from their perspective, they're right. And I'm not going to tell them that, no, that's not what they're experiencing. But to put it into a context and to try to help them educate them about the risks. So the pathway that I see very frequently is you'll have an adolescent and maybe they're a little bit more prone to be anxious or a little bit more prone to be irritable. And they try cannabis, and you know, in the minutes after they do, they feel better. They really do, and they say, "Wow, that this is good." And then it wears off, and they go back to their baseline, and they think, "Oh, I might want to try that again," and they feel better again. And then they come back to their baseline. But then, what happens very often is tolerance starts to develop, and they don't get the same benefits. When they're not using, their baseline starts to creep up. So now when they're not using, they're actually more anxious or more irritable than their baseline is. And that then kind of motivates more use. And this is the way the cycle kind of starts building. And pretty soon you've got a kid who is more anxious, more suspicious, more irritable, much more than their baseline. And this is how you get to this office visit where one person is saying, I think this drug is really messing up your life. And you have another kid saying, this is the only thing that works. And in a sense, they're both right. But you have to sort of appreciate this cycle. And so my response to them is, I get it. I get that immediately after you use this, you feel better and you deserve to feel better. But in the long term, this is probably working against you. And it's going to be very hard for me to be able to help you with the goals that you want and the way that you want to feel with cannabis still in your life. And that's kind of what I talk about. And then I also try to talk to the parents, because parents often don't know what to do. Do I punish kids? Do I ignore it? Do I give them? I mean, there are so many different issues that come up with parents, and having a discussion with them about how they can help their kid is crucial, because as we talked about before, I really think one of the best ways to help kids is to help their parents.
Yeah, that's important. You know, when I see people, it helps with my anxiety. I ask, well, how long have you been using? And if it's a long time, then what they're treating is really their withdrawal. Because withdrawal, you know, if I ask my patients, can you quit? Because you need to quit. And they say, oh, yeah, I could quit anytime. And then they're there next week still. Because it's, and I just right off say, it's not easy to quit. And their withdrawal from cannabis is real. It's not like opioid or alcohol withdrawal where you're shaking and getting sick. It's more like coffee withdrawal where you're anxious and you can't sleep and you have a headache. And if you feel like you're needing it because you're anxious without it, it's because you're treating your withdrawal symptoms.
Yeah, that's such an important point, Dr. Levin. I'm glad you do that. And I think that's worse. Talking about, if I have an adolescent who is in a place where they're ready to cut back and they get it and they want to try, I really try to mention that, because what often happens is an adolescent will say, okay, I'm going to listen to you. I'm going to give this a try. And they stop. And in the immediate period after, they feel worse. And what they are experiencing is withdrawal. But what they're interpreting this state as their, this is what I'll feel like if I don't use cannabis. And so I do often need to try to educate them that this is not your baseline, that there could be a period where you're going to feel a little bit worse, but hang in there. And very, very likely that period will pass and you will feel much better down the road. And it's been very gratifying. You know, some kids really resist that, but some listen, and it's been really gratifying to see some pretty dramatic turnarounds for some kids who have been able to take that advice, to accept support, and to cut back or stop, and really see their personality emerge again, and see a lot of this anxiety and irritability and lack of motivation and mental fog just lift. And some of them are just so grateful for that. And that's one of the things that makes my job very rewarding.
And that's the crime we're making as a profession when we don't make that diagnosis. We rob people from the opportunity of that type of freedom and recovery.
Yeah, I think we really have to be honest that we think this is a major player in where things are at, and we think that it's an essential piece of recovery. And I just feel like we've got to be honest. That doesn't mean we judge them or diminish how hard it is sometimes to stop. But I think if we ignore it, we are doing a disservice.
How big a problem is this in your field? I think I had one psychiatrist say that probably 100% of their first onset psychosis break has a marijuana association. How big a problem is you're seeing this, and is it more again in your longevity as a psychiatrist?
It's hard to say. I wouldn't give the 100% statistic. I certainly see kids and adolescents with really no substance use whatsoever who can develop psychotic illness. And to be honest, I see it playing a really big role in my kids with in adolescents with anxiety and irritability and things like school attendance, and which I think is becoming a bigger and bigger problem, and something that I hope we're going to address nationally soon. Just the number of kids who are not going to school, struggling to go to school. I have never seen anything.
And this is not homeschooling. These are kids who are just truant.
Yeah, these are kids who can't get to, for one reason or another, feel like they can't get to school. Sometimes parents will try quote homeschooling for a while, and very often that doesn't really stick either. So I'm seeing.
And is this a post-COVID phenomenon where kids were like not going to school and then kind of got used to that?
I think COVID definitely played a role in this. Definitely were some kids where it seemed like the homeschooling or school from home started this, and it just was hard to get back. Yeah, I do think COVID has been playing a role in this as well.
Wow, the damage, the repercussions of that are continuing. So you talked to us how you talk to parents, how you talk to young people. What about your father and your children? What do you say to them about drugs?
Well, I think one of the occupational hazards is that my kids know that this is an issue that I talk about, and in some ways that's a good thing because it has sparked some discussions among them. And as I say, oh, I'm going to do this podcast, or I'm giving this lecture, what are you going to talk about? Oh, I'm going to talk about, you know, so it does sort of lend itself to having some discussions about this. I think for younger kids, I think it's good to talk to young kids about this. A nice place to start for younger kids may not to be asking them directly about their use, but about what the culture is at your school. Do you know about kids? Do people get asked? Is there temptations? It's a nice way to sort of broach the subject. And then I also feel like it's really clear with adolescents to state your expectation. I don't want you using cannabis or other drugs. I think it will be harmful to you, and I expect that you will not use. I mean, just to be really clear about that, because sometimes adolescents get mixed signals, particularly when parents may be using cannabis too. And well, why is it okay that you do it and not okay for me? That can be a good discussion to have, and setting, being a role model, I think, can be important. So it's an important issue to bring up. Parents, it can be a struggle. There are resources out there to help with some of the conversations, and it can be something to bring to a primary care clinician or a mental health clinician as well to help, because they are tricky, and you don't want to be judging people and just turning people away either.
Yeah. Parenting styles. And that brings us to one of your books, Parenting Made Complicated, What the Science Really Knows About the Greatest Debates of Childhood. So I'm told that my husband and I were very strict parents. My kids would say like, oh, you're strictest parents in all the high school. They would say that, but I think that they were kind of proud of that too, because it kind of gave them a safety net. So I don't know if parenting is by like, oh, being a friend to your kids, you know, being their pal, or having too much discipline. It's always, you never know, I think, even in your middle of it, if you're doing the right job or not. Now that my kids are adults, I can judge it better. But I'm wondering, what do you say in your book, in the different parenting styles?
Well, the reason I called the book Parenting Made Complicated is that I think that the majority of parenting guidance out there is really delivered in a one size fits all way. Like, this is the right thing, and this is what you should do to all kids. And I started my career as a researcher in child temperament and personality. And so one of the main themes of the book is that the answer to a lot of parenting questions is it depends. And it depends.
Oh, that's such a psychiatrist way to answer.
Right. And it depends is a terrible way to answer a question, but it's not a bad place to start. And so the best strategy, whether it be parenting style or a particular issue, might be very different. If you have a kid who's more anxious, or you have a kid who is an exceptional risk taker, or if you have a kid who loses their cool. There are some universal principles. The beginning of the book, the first lines of the book are, all kids need love, all kids need limits. After that, things get complicated. So I think there are some universal principles about warmth and support and guidance and limits, but there's a lot that can vary, and we really, I would be skeptical of the one size fits all parenting. And in the book, I try to look at different issues, whether it be daycare, discipline, screen use, parenting styles, and describe in sort of easy to understand language about how things might be different depending on if you have one of five different temperament types of kid.
Corporal punishment, a spanking?
That one, interestingly, it's very hard to find evidence that corporal punishment really does anything good. But the research when it comes to corporal punishment is quite murky. We have never been able to do the definitive study to really answer that, and we never will, because the idea that you would take a group of 1,000 parents and say, okay, I'm going to flip a coin, and if it's heads, you're not going to ever spank for, you know, the next X years, and if it's tails, you are, under these conditions, and so no one would ever sign up for that study, and so we have to use other means to figure that out. But it may be that it is not as harmful with some types of kids than others, but we've never really been able to see that it's a good thing for anyone.
I know the answer. It depends. your other book, Child Temperament, New Thinking and Boundary Traits, and between traits and illness, give us a little glimpse of that. I want to promote your work.
Well, like I said, I started my research, my career as a researcher. And that was one of the things I was really interested in, is because I came from a psychology background and I learned about personality traits and temperament traits. And then I did my psychiatry training. And I started asking questions like, well, wait a minute, I've learned about this concept called shyness, and now there's this disorder called social anxiety disorder. What's the difference? What's the difference between what we call an active child and what we call a hyperactive child? Like, where do I draw the line? It was an important question for me clinically, because that's what parents would come to me and say. And they would say, look, I get it that my six-year-old boy is not supposed to have this awesome attention span, but is this more than that? Or it's like, a parent would come in and say, I get that teenagers are supposed to be moody, but is there more than that? And it's a struggle to figure out where to draw the line. And the bottom line for many of this is that we don't have really good benchmarks. That many of these things that we work with in mental health really are dimensional. I sometimes, when I'm educating parents about ADHD, I say, diagnosing somebody with ADHD is a bit like telling somebody that they're tall. There are people that everybody agrees are tall. There are people that everybody agrees are not tall. And there's a whole bunch of people that are kind of right in the middle, and it's sort of arbitrary whether you call them tall or not. And I really think that that's how the brain works when it comes to a lot of the conditions that we work with in the mental health field.
That's true. And then I think, you know, I relate to that as everything is on a bell-shaped curve, right? You know, really tall, really short, in between, and the same with anxiety or anything else. Have you seen that bell-shaped curve switch over the years, move to the right? Are there more kids with anxiety? And
absolutely. And, yeah, so there really is no question that the threshold, or sometimes what I call the speed limit for what counts as a disorder, a psychiatric condition, has dropped. Probably the places where I've seen that the most is autism and ADHD are two conditions where it's very clear that what counts has fallen over the past few decades. What is controversial is whether that's a good thing or a bad thing.
Fallen or increased? Like, we have more incidences of...
We have higher rates of things like autism and ADHD because the threshold for what counts has fallen.
Okay.
Yeah. Sorry if that was not clear. So people now argue, well, is this a good thing or a bad thing? Because on the one hand, we're offering help to people that we wouldn't have in the past, but there can also be negative consequences.
So are you saying that the incident hasn't really changed, but our diagnosis has increased?
Well, it's very clear to me that the diagnosis has increased. There may be other reasons why there are actual increases as well. So again, we phrase it as an or, but it's probably an and. So for things like autism, we're having kids later in life. Advanced parental age is one factor that may be related to. So there actually may be reasons why there are real increases. At the same time, it's very clear that we're making this diagnosis more frequently because we're lowering what counts.
I like that and or thing. I'm gonna try to work that into my thing.
I mean, as you've probably gathered, I do a lot of it depends thinking, a lot of I really try to embrace the complexity. I know that can be frustrating for people who like clear answers, but the brain is probably the most complicated thing that has ever been put on this planet, and I think we just have to deal with it as best we can.
Psychology Today, you have a blog, you're a very gifted writer, and you write different things. As I encourage the audience to kind of check out your blog. One of the things, several of the articles there struck me. One was like, are my medications working? And I see that because any adult who uses marijuana, I say, hey, take out drugs.com and just make sure that your medications, your blood pressure medications, your blood thinners don't interact with cannabis or CBD for that matter, because your psychiatrist is not going to tell you, your pharmacist isn't going to tell your doctor. You have to really check this for yourself. And I know it's an issue in psychiatry because a lot of psychiatric medications interact with cannabis. And I'm wondering if that's something that you do too, and you saying, well, your medications aren't working for you because there's interference.
Yes, I do bring that up. There is evidence that substances can, I don't know if this is too extreme a word, but sabotage the beneficial effects of other types.
They alter the metabolism.
Yes. And in some cases, as you mentioned, they can have direct interactions and affect how other medications are metabolized and how they can access the brain. And so, yeah, this is a really important piece. And I try to remind folks of that, and they, when people come and they say, well, my antidepressant is not working or my ADHD medicine is not working, sometimes I feel like I have to say, well, you are still using these substances, and maybe that's that's part of the reason. And then it's, and sometimes you have to do that a few times for before someone comes around and says, okay, well, let's give it a try. Again, I try not to be too judgmental about it, and accept where people are, but at the same time, I'm not going to just keep spinning my wheels and keep prescribing riskier and riskier medications if I think that one of the things that needs to happen is in this other area, whether it be substance use or some other kind of environmental factor.
Interesting that you bring that into safe prescribing, like, okay, if this is going to be the thing, then I can't give you more of that. We did that back in the days of opioids. That's what we taught. Yeah, that's great. All right, let's just end a little bit with solutions. What are some of the solutions that we could do for this with the problem? I think there are solutions, you know, regulatory solutions, you know, for society as far as, you know, banning the candies and potencies. And we didn't even talk about this, but childproof packaging, because the number one, I don't think you see kids that long, but I mean, it's like babies, 2 years old and younger, getting into their parents' candy is the number one cause of pediatric poisonings in our country, and various contaminants. Or we could also talk about solutions within our own profession, something that we should own about the gaps in education and documentation. And want to hear from you. What do you think needs to happen?
I agree with you. I think education at all levels is really important. I would love to see some good public health campaigns out there, particularly with cannabis, not to be fear-mongering and scare people with overly alarming things, but to really lay it out there. We saw with nicotine that these can be really quite effective. And I think for youth, sometimes you have to appeal to things other than the, oh, it might be bad for you argument. I think one of the lessons we learned from nicotine is that there are other ways to get people to think twice about nicotine use, that it's not just about health risks, but it's about maybe talking about environmental concerns. It's about talking about how big companies are trying to manipulate you for their own profit. These are the kind of things that can sometimes gain traction for adolescents, even more than, oh, you might have this bad thing happen 50 years from now.
You're being tricked.
Yes, right. So, and then for professionals, I would like to see substance use, cannabis and other substances being taught a little bit more. I think it's a gap in a lot of training programs. And just from talking to other medical and mental health professionals, many of them say, I just never heard this stuff. This is really important. I wish somebody had talked to me about this sooner.
Yeah. So in that effect, I'm wondering if there is something we could do to work together, and we could take it offline, but just kind of several ideas kind of we had is one is a resolution to the American Academy of Pediatrics about protecting kids and marijuana, or in I remember back with opioid prescriptions, I submitted guidance to the anticipatory guidance with kids at certain ages, like right when you're certain when you learn to ride your bicycle, teach parents to put on a helmet. Or at that time, I said, you know, lock away medications at your house and grandma's house when kids were getting into opioids. I'm wondering if we could do that too with marijuana. And finally, if we could even just write some type of article to encourage not just mental health professionals and emergency physicians to go ahead and use that diagnosis of cannabis-induced psychosis, opt in rather to think that this is a diagnosis of exclusion in order to give people the benefit of the doubt for their health, actually. You want to have that diagnosis. That's a better diagnosis to have than to have a permanent psychosis.
I like all those ideas. I'd be happy to work with you on some of those. I did for my child psychiatry professional organization write up a tip sheet similar to what you were talking about how do you talk about you know, what should you do regarding things like exercise and nutrition at various stages of development? I didn't include things about substance use prevention, and that could probably be added to that.
That's awesome. That's great. All right, Dr. David Ritu, thank you so much for all you do, for your education of me and everybody else, your work for your patients, and you take that experience I could see and reach across the country with your writing and your advocacy and not being afraid to talk. And I so appreciate that.
Well, thank you, Dr. Lev. This is really a pleasure, and I really appreciate all the important work and advocacy that you're doing as well.
Thank you for listening to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where you learn from experts from around the globe and around all aspects of drugs and addiction. This week's episode would not be possible without the generous support of our sponsor. A sincere and warm thank you to Physicians for Healthy Communities. Visit physiciansforhealthycommunities.org and view their video and resource library. High Truths producer is Dave Rivas from Davey Boy Productions. I'm your host, Dr. Ronit Lev. We hope we brought your day a little bit more High Truths.